Paramedic here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. Now, if you've watched or listened to this show over the last 2 years, you know my deep belief that we need to spend more time focusing on how to solve the problems we face rather than just endlessly fixating on the problems themselves. Now, that's what's always motivated me as an author and historian during my recent run for Congress and, of course, over my career as a journalist. Too much of our civic debate is centered around our divisions, as deep and dangerous as they are. Too little time is spent dedicated to figuring out how we can empower citizens to find common ground rooted in common sense and actually make progress together, so we can do our part to reunite the United States of America. Now today, I'm announcing I'm wrapping up my run here at the Bulwark after 2 years. But How to Fix It is going to go on. We're going to have an exciting announcement about a new partner in the coming weeks. And in the meantime, you can always follow my Substack and social media handles at John Avlon for updates as I heads down finishing my next book, Theodore Roosevelt's Guide to Life, which will be out next year. But right now, I can't think of a better episode to bring you as our closing episode with the Bulwark than this interview, because it's about the essential virtue that seems in too rare supply these days. Talking about courage. Ry Barcutt is a U.S. Marine, co-founder of With Honor, and in his new book, Courage Can Save Us, he looks at profiles of current members of Congress, both on the left and the right, people who are willing to buck their party, to reach out, show courage and independence. It's a profile in courage for our time. So now, Ry Barcutt, welcome to How to Fix It.
Great to be on. Thanks, John.
So this book, your second, is sort of a profiles in courage look at 10 people who serve in politics, who've had military service, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats. Tell me why you decided to write this book now.
Yeah, thanks, John. I co-founded with a few good friends of ours involved, Elliot Ackerman and KB, Khalil Byrd, and many others, With Honor about 8 years ago, really as an instrument to trying to fix the massive problem of polarization, and particularly as it manifests in the Congress, by helping to elect the next generation of veterans in particular, but also folks that had served. And so I'd been at this with the best hours of my life for the last 9 years. I also realized that I love writing. I got that from my parents. My mom's an anthropologist. My dad was a sociologist. They love books. And it had been 15 years since I had written my initial book. And I wanted to document this moment in time, which I think is a particularly perilous moment, as you cover repeatedly in your extraordinary show. But do so in a way that can particularly connect with younger Americans that are not feeling particularly partisan themselves, that are confused about perhaps about the direction that the country's going, and to highlight a number of individuals that I think are truly extraordinary, that have exhibited a degree of noteworthy courage in an environment that most people assume just has very little of it, and frankly does have very little of it in our public life. So we've worked as an organization with many, many folks over the years. We've evaluated over 2,000 veterans that have run. We support a group of about 50. I selected 5 from each side that are currently serving, and then basically walked with them, went to many of their hometowns, tried to understand where their courage, which I define as a decision. It is a specific choice. It's not instinctive. It's a decision to serve something that is larger than yourself. Where did that come from in moments of pressure? And for all of them, it goes back to their upbringing and their initial decision to serve, to put their life at risk by serving in the United States military. For many of those, it was after September 11th, but for two, it was prior to September 11th. So that was really the genesis of the book. I started about 3 years ago, and then started racing to get it out right in before America's 250th, which we're delighted to be doing.
Well, and it's an important story. And, you know, the folks you cover are people like, you know, the current New Jersey Governor Mike Sherrill, Todd Young from Indiana, Senator Mark Kelly, Governor Wes Moore, Congressman Fitzpatrick, Dan Crenshaw, Seth Moulton, John James, Don Bacon, and Jared Golden. All really interesting, compelling figures in their own right. And in many, but not all cases, you say, sort of members of the 9/11 generation. I wonder, though, when you distill it all down, each has their own fascinating story and journey, and or some are major political figures or rising political figures in our nation's firmament. What is the connective tissue you found? What is the unifying narrative behind all their interesting differences?
Yeah, well, I really view it as courage, that they have found it in their own intestinal fortitude, and in this case, typically moral courage, the putting of one's reputation, sometimes their integrity at risk to stand for something oftentimes that is unpopular, and take the arrows that come with it. It is not easy. And so that is what I looked for, the manifestation of that. Folks that were trying to do the right thing for the most part. it doesn't mean everybody's perfect, and you know, this is a high pressure environment, but then also individuals that I knew. So the connective tissue really is around this idea of courage. I think we need a lot more of it. I do believe that it can save us. It's a strident claim. But I think that it is a source of salvation for our country and for individuals. Why? Because at the end of the day, it is about service. And as you've covered, as you yourself have done throughout your life, but also have covered in this show, fewer and fewer Americans have that connective tissue of serving the country in any capacity, whether that's in nonprofit work, military, federal civilian service, state service. You know, by most estimates, less than 2% of Americans are serving in either the military or in federal civilian service, like AmeriCorps, things of that nature. And the experience unites you in a powerful and profound way, and a way that enables you to at least understand and respect differences across the country.
And that's the unifying force and the cohesion that comes. You write beautifully about your friendship and mentorship with David Gergen in particular, who sort of challenged you, decried the decline of members of the military serving in Congress, and thought that was contributing to the polarization. And indeed, I believe those numbers have doubled since With Honor was started. But what's interesting to me is that you are drawing the explicit connection between somebody's courage under fire, grace under fire, their courage in military, but their courage in public service at a time when that does seem to be atrophying. People forget perhaps that John F. Kennedy's book Profiles in Courage was about unpopular stands.
Most of whom are like faded into obscurity. Fascinating thing. I mean, the book is now 70 It'll be 70 years old this fall, and we'll be doing an event at the JFK Library. It was also the book that really started me on this kind of journey. I read a copy of it in David Gergen's personal library, had this incredible experience of an independent study with him on speechwriting. I didn't get into his class, and so I pitched him and said, "Hey, could I just study speechwriting with you?" And he said, "Sure, come to my home book library and read the books." And the incredible thing about that was many things, but most incredibly was that he took notes in all of the books over the years that he was in the White House advising, you know, four different presidents from four different parties. So I not only was reading Profiles in Courage, and I think, you know, the second book was, you know, like Peggy Noonan's, you know, testimony, But I was reading his notes from when he was in the arena and then re-engaging with those texts together with him every week. Would sit down and basically talk for 45 minutes. So it was an extraordinary experience. And Kennedy's book, I think, is really commendable on this, again, because they were individuals that took real risk and paid, in many cases, significant cost and consequence for that. The book that I've written, it has an important distinction, which is that I've written it while individuals are actively in office.
Yes.
That was largely because I've been able to develop some trust and deep relationships with individuals. It creates an opportunity for a lens into this moment in time. It also creates a lot of challenges as a writer, because I'm trying with this book to be accurate and true. And accuracy and truth is that all humans are flawed.
That's true. You make a great point that courage is not meaning being perfect. Courage matters because we're not perfect, I think you say.
You got it. And in this case, I'm working with sitting electeds. Many of them are still in the arena, and I'm writing chapters that they have approved of, but that try to give the fullness of their character. So I focus on the moments when they stepped up, not necessarily certain moments when maybe they didn't live up to what they would have liked to have done in a particular, instance.
Well, and perfect's never on the menu, but this is a moment where we're calling out for courage. Don Bacon has stood up to his party. He is retiring, but a distinguished American, really stood up to his president on Ukraine in particular. Dan Crenshaw, Republican, stood up to Tucker Carlson, just lost a primary in part because of that fight. And yet others like Wes Moore and Mikey Sherrill are governors and are rising stars who some people look to as a possible future president.
Yeah. And by the way, John, on the West piece was interesting for me, because I went into the book planning to write principally about his decision to not support a movement to create a study around reparations. And I do discuss that in the chapter. But one of the things that most stands out to me about his courage, in political courage, was that when he first ran for office, his advisors were all basically telling him, don't run on the platform that you want to run on, which is addressing childhood poverty. Why? Because kids that are poor don't vote. And frankly, oftentimes their parent, and it's usually a parent, single parent, struggling to make ends meet, also isn't that politically engaged. But it was his North Star, and he stuck to it, and he still sticks to it. And so there are many moments throughout this book where the it was a surprise to me. It was something that I didn't realize that I've tried to surface. But at its core, it's saying, listen, when everybody is telling me do the opposite thing, but when I know it's the right damn thing, I'm gonna damn the torpedoes and go for it.
But that's also about understanding the unique light that one has to bring to the world. If you get caught off from that authenticity, you're never going to be able to shine on your deepest level. And that's a form of courage, I think, to your point, that people don't always look to. But it's also the opposite of courage often is conformity, particularly in politics. And you write really eloquently in places about the ancient Greek and Roman republics. And you write, history suggests that great civilizations such as ancient Greece and Rome are rarely undone by conquest alone. More often they erode from within, weakened by corruption, internal strife, and civic decline. Now, obviously, that's an echo to what we're dealing with today, and it resonates deeply with me.
Well, yeah, and John, I shared with you, I revisited your extraordinary book on Washington's Farewell this morning with my son. And one of the things that you write in your first chapter that he picked up on, and I did as well, was that, Washington's Farewell address, of course, identified partisanship as a great threat, but it also identified our, debt and foreign wars. And wow, we are in a moment with all three, all three coming together.
We are. And that's why I do think it's not too much to sort of talk about every generation having a rendezvous with destiny, and that it is our responsibility to step up, and that courage is directly connected to the common good. It's not just, you make a distinction between courage and bravery, which I find fascinating, which is basically that courage is not simply what we do in the moment. It's the choice.
That's right. And that it is that bravery can be self-serving. But courage is always serving something larger than yourself. That's how I define it. Some can argue about it. It comes from the Stoics and the ancient philosophers. And that's, you know, Stoicism really put courage as the first of the four virtues, you know, that it's the virtue that kind of hinges the other three together.
That's right. And you write about, you know, Admiral Stockdale and James Mattis and other sort of military figures who've absorbed Stoicism, and each of the virtues are reflected in their own way by the figures you profile. But I want to talk about the incentive structure that we've gotten so terribly wrong in our politics, where showing integrity, where pursuing the common good, where exhibiting courage isn't just table stakes. But it's that it's really remarkable because of the pressures to conform in a partisan way, and what you look to as the solutions to fix that. Obviously, With Honor is dedicated to that principle. But why are we seeing the atrophying occur now at such a perilous pace?
Yeah, in many respects, our politics and our media, our information landscape discourages courage. Yep. It discourages it. It rewards, particularly in Congress, following the herd, conforming to to your party. Keep your head down. There's a saying among members, you know, hope, vote no, but hope yes. Oftentimes, you know, in the halls or when I'm talking with members trying to see if they want to make a crossover vote, they'll say something like, "Well, you don't really need me. If you really need me, come to me. But if you don't really need me, I'm just gonna, you know, vote with the tribe here." You know, why does that occur in this environment? And really, what can we do about it? As an organization, one of the things that we try to really focus on are primary races, in particular, on the political arm of the organization, because, you know, vast majority of our districts are safe districts. That's gotten worse now with this historic mid-cycle redistricting, which is such a cancer. But they're safe districts. And so the elections, of course, depend on the primary voters. Primary voters are generally a sliver of the electorate. They're often the most ideological of the electorate. And what we've found is that it's the area, especially when there's an open seat, and, you know, in some of the races that we're in right now, Democratic, Republican seats, you have 10, 11 different candidates running. Nobody knows any of them. None of them are really raising a lot of money. So you can sometimes help get a decent person through that will be more governance minded. There's a trade-off that I think is embodied by this kind of clippy saying now, but is really true. And that is, if you get into this office, do you want to be a show horse or a workhorse? Dan Crenshaw in his chapter put it a different way. He said, do you want to be someone or do something? It's very difficult to do both. His chapter's unique in the 10, not only because he lost his primary race, but because he was the member that was most able to try and essentially do both, to have a major communications platform. In his case, there were only two other electeds in the entire United States who have a larger following on their podcasts, Ted Cruz and Gavin Newsom. So he had this very large following, but he was also trying to be a serious legislator on issues that he cared deeply about. And as his example illustrates, it is very difficult to do that these days. And so I don't think there are obvious solutions, and I'm happy to go kind of deeper into this piece. But what we try to do as an organization is help change some of the incentives, be there for individuals when they take a tough vote and it gets pretty quiet. And it often does. I mean, especially these votes where you're crossing party lines, it gets pretty quiet. I mean, it can get pretty quiet with your friends and family and the people that you care most about.
And that's part of the tragedy here, right? Because Congress, it was set up to work where people vote their conscience and their common sense and cross party lines to solve common problems. But it's the lack of competitive districts that certainly is a driving factor. And the other one is, as you point out, at the midpoint of the 20th century, service was a given. You had an enormous amount of connective tissue in terms of the experiences people had across partisan and regional lines. And I wonder what you think about national service, new national service norms. Pete Buttigieg campaigned on them in one cycle. Wes Moore is doing a pilot. But an expanded version of national service. You mentioned AmeriCorps earlier as an expanded vision of service. But I wonder what you think about that as a way of rebalancing the scale towards those sort of unifying experiences.
I like how you cover this as well as civic education in your programs. And one of the early priorities of our organization, successful so far, has been to expand JROTC units in public high schools across the country. We're now up to about 4,000, about doubled in the last few years, with a large focus of this coalition of veterans, about 50, about a dozen in the Senate and about 38 in the House. So I view civic education also as part and parcel to getting more Americans to a path of service, which I believe is not only good for the country, it's good for those individuals. It's good for this crisis of purpose that we face as a country. There have been a lot of attempts to expand voluntary national service. Somebody that I respect on our advisory board once referred to it as like the Marshall Plan. You know, it gets invoked a lot as a part of a solution. I think it gets invoked a lot because it can be part of a solution. And it's one of these remarkable 80-20 issues. Yep. There are not many 80-20 issues anymore, but this is one of them where conservatives and liberals think alike. There's high degree of interest in service among even the most ideological of conservatives, what folks refer to as a MAGA conservatives. So the idea has a concrete following. So why can't we do more about it? AmeriCorps as a whole engages about 100,000 young Americans. When DOGE came around this last year, one of the really misguided decisions, I think, that doesn't get a lot of airtime is that they said they were not going to cut the individuals that are on their year of service, but then an email went out and eliminated those positions. Then they had to contest it, and the courts essentially rolled back that decision. But that discourages, obviously, young Americans who, by the way, are taking basically poverty rate wages. It's about $20,000 a year. It's one of the critiques of the program is that that makes it less accessible for lower income Americans to serve. So there have been mistakes. It hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. I think that there could be a real window. I do think that it could be across party lines. I know it can be. We're in a moment in time, obviously, where the technology displacements are significant. The fear is even larger, I think. And a lot of young people are feeling that pressure in particular. I was with a group of computer scientists that graduated within the last year and they haven't found a job.
This is one of the interesting things is I think, as we deal with AI and the disruptions it will provide in the economy, the argument for national service gets stronger, not weaker. Because you're giving people job experience and an opportunity to serve while they find their way. And so I think hopefully that will be added to the conversation. Theoretically, this is bipartisan. But as so many bipartisan things that are 80% agenda issues, that falls apart in Congress because there's not the courage and the will.
Yeah. And it's cheap too, by the way. It's like so what are conservatives really like about this? I think based on the polling, is that it's not expensive. It's about $1 billion. That compares to about a budget of over $1 trillion for our Defense Department. It also focuses on skill building. This is not simply volunteerism. It's developing skills that can translate into jobs. So let's not talk about necessarily a blank check or something like this. It's like, hey, here's something you can actually do.
And that's one thing Wes Moore is really focused on in his version in Maryland, is exactly that angle. I want to talk about the military, not only as a cohesive unifying force and the 9/11 generation and the way that that is a the evolution of our generation, but specifically in the case of Don Bacon, he's dealing with this rapid flip-flop of his party on issues of international security, particularly with regard to Ukraine and standing up to Vladimir Putin, and finds himself basically often alone. And you all have supported that. So how do you and how do he understand the reversal of the Republican Party on standing up to Russian aggression?
I would add Brian Fitzpatrick in this. Sure. The chapter talks about how he decided to hold back on voting for One Big Beautiful Bill. He was only one of two Republicans to not vote for that, largely based on a freeze that had occurred within days of the vote related to a Ukraine and weapons and intelligence sharing and things of that nature. I think it's very bizarre that we're in this situation. It is, as Don speaks about, feels like the opposite of the Reagan Republican kind of position on the place of the United States in the world. That being said, we obviously are living through a rise of tremendous populism that does cross both ideological spectrums, albeit it shows itself differently on the Democratic side. We work with a lot of Republicans. Most that at least I've affiliated with recognize the threat of Russian aggression and are essentially privately saying things like, we cannot bankroll this war forever. We understand that. There is some good, I think, that has occurred from pushing back on European allies to contribute to the mm-hmm. war effort. So that's oftentimes what they will highlight. But it does mystify me that we haven't seen more voices. If the Russian aggression made more headway, would more of Republicans break on this issue? I think it's possible that they would. Frankly, it has been remarkable, just absolutely remarkable what the Ukrainians have done, especially in the last 6 months, of essentially gaining a technological advantage that is making the numerical, disproportionate numerical advantage of Russia, at bay. But I believe, and I think Don Bacon does, and Brian Fitzpatrick, that this is an issue that's much larger than one particular country. It is about America's place in the world, and it is about the fight for freedom and democracy.
So I of course agree with you, and I salute them for having the courage of their convictions and consistency. And you talk about a populist movement. Obviously, the president campaigned against foreign wars, and I think the 9/11 generation particularly is sensitive to Middle East wars that are open ended. And the collective experience with that. But then on the flip side, we've got Iran now. How do you understand that piece of it, which is obviously the opposite? It's direct military intervention. It's not boots on the ground yet, but entirely open-ended. How do the members you speak to, how do you internalize it? And then we'll get to the Western Hemisphere. I just got to get your takes on all this. How you see it fit together. Round the World with Ry Barkat. That's your next show.
Yeah, personally, I mean, I believe this feels like at least it's an 80-20 issue. I don't know whether that's the case, but it certainly feels that way. The wars that our generation fought in, I served in Iraq and Afghanistan, what Dexter Filkins coined the forever wars, are deeply unpopular because they dragged on for so long with such inconclusive ends. So I was very surprised by the, not necessarily that there was a military strike, because obviously we saw earlier strikes with considerable success on Iranian positions mm-hmm. following the assault on Israel, which I think is also very important to, for everybody to recognize that Iran has been a, hostile, brutal regime.
No question.
That was certainly behind October 7th, et cetera. But wars require planning and careful deliberation. And it certainly feels like, especially when we're sort of following the comments of the president, which it just feels like that many of our decisions are being made on a whim as opposed to with deep planning. I hope that's not the case. And I hope that this thing can come to some type of resolution. I think most Americans do as well. I won't speak for the Republicans within Congress, but those that have concerns, and I know that there are many, I think are also, you know, at the edge saying, wondering when is this going to, when if ever is there going to be a resolution here? Obviously there's a significant economic toll as well with the Strait of Hormuz. At the end of the day for us though, as an organization is, we want to make sure this group, which is one of the only groups that still meets, that still has trust, can actually get behind closed doors as they do and have serious conversations about this with trust and not have to worry about, you know, the member from the other side going and throwing out a tweet or jumping on cable news and saying either such and such just said this or concealing their identity, but using the information.
No, and I don't want you to spill tea, but I want you to explain to people what you're talking about, because we talked about With Honor.
Sure.
But there's a caucus of military members, particularly younger, that is across aisle. So explain how that works, because
that's right.
It really is a part of the problem-solving ethos.
That's right. And many of the individuals that are profiled in this book have participated in this caucus. Not all of them, some were not in Congress or in the Senate arm of the organization. But this, what With Honor does is this nonprofit organization that then supports the work of an official congressional caucus called the Four Country Caucus, FOR Country Caucus. It's co-chaired by Jake Elsey and Don Davis and was founded by Don Bacon and Jimmy Panetta about 8 years ago. And this caucus, along with Honor support and other veteran service organizations that we bring along for specific issues, generally passes about 100 pieces of legislation each year, principally that are national security focused and go through the National Defense Authorization Act, which is one of the only bipartisan pieces of legislation that typically, and knock on woods, will continue to still pass each year. So the caucus develops trust by working with each other. There are many issues that they don't agree on or are not able to, you know, tackle, but there are also a huge set that they've been able to focus on. And those range from issues like the NATO Support Act, which restricts the executive's ability to unilaterally pull us from NATO,
important.
To support for key allies. Yep.
Very important. That NATO piece just might save our bacon, no pun intended. Before we go, I want to touch base on Venezuela from your perspective. I'm not asking to spill tea on folks, just help folks understand how it's being received among the veterans. And then now there's, you know, rumors of similar suspicious actions around Cuba. This is, of course, the opposite of ending forever wars. It's the opposite of the alleged rationale for not standing up stronger against Russian invasion of Ukraine. And yet here we are possibly looking at, Trump talking about Venezuela becoming the 51st state and some chatter around Cuba now. How do you see that?
And of course, Congress is supposed to authorize, you know, the use of force and wars. But the polarization of the place makes it just difficult to get anything done, let alone major issues. And so, you know, there's been a erosion of checks and balances that's occurred in a bipartisan way over the last, certainly since we've been at this work. On Venezuela specifically, I mean, it is fascinating just sort of how the news cycle moves and the pace of activity. I honestly don't hear much about it, even though it was a dramatic event, and from a military execution standpoint, stunning. I mean, stunning event. Just in terms of the pure execution, but it does raise these larger questions of just what is the role of the United States? What is specifically Congress going to do about actions that are unilateral, if anything? It seems increasingly that Congress just, you know, does not take actions. I do think, though, at the end of the day, these are representatives that are elected by the American public. And if the American public gets into the zone of the 80-20, as it, I believe it is, on foreign escapades right now, that can, I think, create a certain amount of pressure. And you're starting to see it some. There was a initiative this past week by a member of Congress from Michigan, a Republican, who put forward a piece to essentially try to limit additional executive actions if something's not resolved within a certain period of time. I forget the exact details, but related to Iran. So you're starting to see sort of steps. Will they move fast enough? Will it be enough? Not sure.
Making sense of the hypocrisy and the situational ethics is impossible, and that's part of the problem. There's no through line philosophically. It would be one thing if this was just a genuine shift in ideology and philosophy that was at least deeply principled and therefore consistently held. My concern is that it is a devolution back to the idea that might makes right, as opposed to the Lincolnian idea that right makes might, that for all our imperfections is at the heart of the American ideal, because it's all seems to be impulsive and certainly bypassing constitutional structures.
Yeah, there's this really interesting body of research that Peter Fever and others have been involved with. Peter's was a former professor of mine out of Duke University. I did not go to Duke. I went to the other school, but
he says defense
down the road. but Peter is an expert in civil military relations and worked very closely with a mentor of mine, Professor Richard Cohn. And what Peter's research looked into at one point was how individuals who had served in uniform, then gone into national security decisions, made decisions around the use of force. And what he found was that over the course of the last roughly 100 years of American history, that those who had worn the cloth of the nation and served as veterans were generally less likely to commit, to decide to commit U.S. forces to solve problems. But when they did make the decision, they did so with more overwhelming force, essentially, kind of similar to what General Powell ended up sort of formulating, what's sometimes been called the Powell Doctrine. I think that there's larger values questions here about who we are as a nation and what we become. At the epilogue of the book, I come back to this movie that was such a brilliant movie, Platoon. Yeah. And the two protagonists, Barnes and Elias. And one of the pieces there is that they both show America's capacity for both goodness and evil. You know, America has the capacity to do, you know, some terrible things. And we also have the capacity to do some remarkable things and like reinvent ourselves. So, you know, hoping that the better angels of our spirits come forward, and they will come forward if we have good, decent leaders who I believe have to be from both parties. I strongly believe that. That's the other through line to this book, is that it takes a measure of courage today. It's pathetic to say this, but it's true. It takes a measure of courage just to be actually bipartisan in this environment. Even in the purplest of districts, it still takes a measure of courage because of the way that individuals in our politics are punished for in some cases even talking to the other side. You know, there's this amazing episode with President Biden and John McCain where they were sitting next to each other at one of their colleagues' funerals, and somebody afterwards came up to them and said, "Hey, what, you know, you can't be seen sitting next to each other." And they were serious with the comment. That's kind of where we're at.
No, that is. And you've got a beautifully written encapsulation of the difficulty at the end, right before we go. So you say polarization is a cycle that feeds on itself. Government falters, trust diminishes, and anger hardens. Electoral incentives pull many members of Congress toward the ideological edges, where primary voters often reward confrontation and punish compromise. Issues that require bipartisan solutions, housing, healthcare, Social Security, national debt, remain unresolved or handled, addressed in strictly partisan terms, rarely built to last. Trust erodes further, reinforcing a negative feedback loop. Hey, that's a great encapsulation of the problem. And obviously something that I've dedicated a large part of my life and career to warning about and combating. I want you to step back for a second and talk about the 9/11 generation as a specific sub-generation. It is a flow-through line with a lot of the people you cover in the book. And it seems to us as we reach our maturity, 25 years this fall will be the 25th anniversary of 9/11, that it's our responsibility to fix this. And I want your thoughts on the 9/11 generation and what you think we can do.
Of which we are both both members at defining day and coming up on the 25th. Somebody that's played an important role in my life and in With Honor is the author Joe Klein. And Joe wrote a book that focused on the post 9/11 generation as the next greatest generation. And I think in large part at this stage, we have not lived up to that ideal, that very lofty and perhaps unattainable ideal. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive for it. The notion that any one individual is going to bring us to a path of salvation or even a small group, I think is fundamentally flawed. I think Americans have to be able to take ownership of the situation that we're in and be part of this solution. I mean, one of my goals with the book is to not only show or make an argument about why courage matters, but also essentially an argument for encouraging rewarding of courage among the American public. I do believe that many of the individuals of the post 9/11 generation who served, the less than 1% of individuals that served, they are not all necessarily part of the solution. Some are have become very partisan, but there is a group that are part of it, and that's a group that we have supported as an organization. We want to highlight them. It's difficult work that they do. Some will serve for a certain period of time. Some will dedicate their lives to it. But this is a piece to part of the future. And the title of the book came from a comment that Wes Moore made on the campaign trail, which is that service will save us. And Wes's first bill was around creating a service year for young members of Maryland. He did something similar, or he did it not in partnership, but he has collaborated on this with Spencer Cox, a Republican governor from Utah. And so it's kind of circling back. I think that this generation of which I'm one of them, I think there's some risk in overstating that we will, take us to the chosen land. But I think that we will certainly part of the solution, and we need to recognize and celebrate that. And frankly, reward individuals that decide to commit the best years of their life to service, because we're not only discouraging courage, but a lot of the attitudes in American culture now do not celebrate service. I mean, it's more focused on, I think there's a Gallup poll that's out there that the only value that increased for Americans in the last few years was the value of money. That's pretty pathetic, but there's some, we can do things about that as well.
And it is our responsibility too, as citizens of this great American experiment. Rye Barcott, great American, co-founder of With Honor, author of the brand new Courage Can Save Us. Buy it on pre-order, buy it for your friends. It's a profile in courage for our times.
Hey, John, thank you so much. And I'll just do a little shout out too on the book. All the author proceeds are going to With Honor. So we're, if you're grabbing the book, which I appreciate, you're also supporting the mission of the organization to get more Americans serving in different ways.
Love it. Thanks. Be well. You're a good man.
Thanks, John.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this is the final How to Fix It here on the Bulwark feed. But the show will go on with a new partner I'll be announcing in the coming weeks. In the meantime, I'm finishing up my next book, Theodore Roosevelt's Guide to Life, which is about the real meaning of his famous Man in the Arena speech, which is actually about the responsibilities of citizens in a democracy. Yeah, it's a pretty timely topic. I want to thank all of you who've reached out to me over the last 2 years, email your comments, and have just shown a real enthusiasm for the idea of solutions journalism, because it is dramatically underrepresented, even in the wide swath of podcasts and civic debate we have today. So please follow me on Substack and social media if you don't already. Handle is at John Avalon, where my radical centrist perspective on solutions journalism and history will continue. But I want to give my deep thanks to the Bulwark team, especially my excellent production partner and video editor, Rupert Mandenstam. And I want to thank you for listening. Can't wait to see you in the next chapter as we work together to unfuck America.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.